Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver in Washington. Coming up on the program is a look at the so-called Fringe Festival, recently held in the nation's capital. Then, it's another installment of our National Park Series. Ashley Thompson and I head west once again. And, as always, we finish the show with a classic American story. Today, Shep O'Neill reads The Boarded Window by Ambrose Bierce.
Every summer, artists perform at fringe festivals around the world. Fringe festivals are a celebration of strange art. They have all kinds of performers, from dancers, musicians, and actors, to everything in between. The shows give artists, sometimes described as outside the norm, a chance to create unusual art. For festival goers, each show is a time to experience something different. The first Fringe Festival was held in Edinburgh, Scotland in 1947. That was also the year of the first Edinburgh International Festival. Artists from around the world traveled to Scotland for the Edinburgh International Festival. They performed at arts centers throughout the city. Eight local theater companies did not receive an invitation, however. In response, they performed at smaller spaces around Edinburgh. These artists performed wherever they could, including churches and even on the street. They started their own cultural event and named it the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. What started as an alternative to the mainstream has now become the world's largest arts festival. Today, there are hundreds of fringe festivals taking place around the world. The one in Washington, D.C., called the Capital Fringe Festival, is in its 10th year. It was held in the month of July. Julianne Brienza founded the Capital Fringe Festival. She went to a school for the performing arts, but now sees herself mainly as an organizer of the festival. Brienza believes that fringe performance art is special and can have a powerful effect. We live here in D.C., the nation's capital, where there are a lot of large federally funded institutions, she says. So to have a festival about people outside of that system is pretty awesome. It's a good message to local people being important. The Capital Fringe Festival takes place in different locations throughout the D.C. area. Some performances happen in traditional theaters. Others happen in unusual settings like old, empty buildings or stores after business hours are over. Brienza says the purpose of fringe festivals is to explore the limits of art in unique environments. Since 2006, the event has made more than $1.7 million. It is the second largest unjuried French festival in the U.S., and its popularity has grown every year. Rachel Turner is the founder of the Errant Movement Dance Group. Its show, called Connectivity Complexity, used dance and music to ask questions about human relationships in the age of social media. Turner believes that attending one Capital Fringe show motivates audience members to see other performances at the festival. I think it really brings people together. For people who don't necessarily see a lot of performances all the time, it motivates them to see artwork, she says. I think it's good for the artists, but it's really good for people in the city to get out and see more work. Leah Harris was a fringe participant for the first time this year. She performed her one-woman show called Aliens, Nazis, and Angels. In it, she tells the story of her life, her mother, and other members of her family in a series of funny and sometimes sad anecdotes. Harris believes that the festival can help many artists take a risk. The impact it has personally is that seeing some of these other one-person shows makes me think that, hey, I can do that. I can do this in my own little way, and there's a space for me, she says. The Edinburgh Festival Fringe continues throughout the month of August. I'm Patrick Melanchier.
This week on our National Parks Journey, we travel to the northwestern state of Oregon. Here, you will find a huge, deep lake. Its waters seem impossibly blue. It is the deepest lake in America and one of the deepest lakes in the world. Its water is among the clearest and purest found on Earth. Around the lake runs the wall of an extinct volcano. In the middle of the lake, a small island rises over 230 meters above the surface. Welcome to Crater Lake National Park.
The lake's beauty inspires artists, photographers, and nature lovers. That beauty was born from the violent burst of Mount Mazama about 7,700 years ago. Hot liquid called magma rose from deep under the mountain, causing it to collapse. The powerful burst destroyed the surrounding area. Huge amounts of ash fell on the land. The burst also left an enormous circular hole in the mountain's center. Scientists call this a caldera. Over the next hundreds of years, rain and snow filled the hole with water. Rainfall and snowfall are the lake's only source of water. It has no connections to the rivers and streams around it. That is what keeps its waters so pure. As water collected, plants began to grow in the area again, and animals returned. Scientists say it took about 250 years for the lake to rise to its current water level. Crater Lake is 592 meters deep. It is one of the 10 deepest on Earth. But its depth is not the only remarkable quality. People are awed by its water color and clarity. Crater Lake is so clear that on most days you can see nearly 30 meters below the surface. The lake takes on its intense blue color because of the water's clarity. Sunlight reaches deep into the water. Crater Lake gets its name from geology. A crater is a large, bowl-shaped area on top of a volcano. The crater that formed the lake sits within the larger caldera.
Native Americans were in the area even before the lake's formation. Researchers have found artifacts buried under layers of ash and dust from Mount Mazama's huge eruption. Following the burst, Native Americans considered Crater Lake to be a holy place. Ancient Native American stories describe the eruption of Mount Mazama. European explorers and settlers did not arrive in the area until the middle 1800s. In 1865, a hunter became one of the first non-Native Americans to reach the shores of Crater Lake. In 1870, a boy in Kansas read a newspaper article about the strange lake in Oregon. The story about Crater Lake fascinated the young William Gladstone Steele. He promised himself he would one day see this lake. In 1872, Steele's family moved to Portland, Oregon, about 375 kilometers north of the lake. 13 years later, Steele honored his promise and visited Crater Lake. Its beauty moved him greatly. He began a 17-year fight to preserve the area as a public park. Steele was a writer. He described one of his first visits to Crater Lake in 1886 in the West Shore magazine.
Not a foot of the land about the lake has been touched or claimed. An overmastering conviction came to me that this wonderful spot must be saved, wild and beautiful, just as it was, for all future generations.
His proposal of creating a national park did not please nearby sheep herders and miners. But his efforts succeeded anyway. On May 22, 1902, Crater Lake became the country's fifth national park. It remains the only national park in Oregon. And William Gladstone Steele is called the father of Crater Lake.
Crater Lake National Park covers 740 square kilometers. The lake itself makes up less than 10% of the park. It also includes surrounding mountains and thick forests. The trees shelter many kinds of animals, from black bears to elk to spotted owls. About 480,000 people visit Crater Lake National Park each year. They explore by car, bicycle, or on foot. Roads that encircle Crater Lake usually are open from July through October, depending on weather. They provide breathtaking displays of the lake's unusual blue color, as well as the forests around it. Crater Lake National Park also has more than 140 kilometers of hiking trails. The Cleetwood Cove Trail drops more than 200 meters down to the edge of Crater Lake. It leads to a spot where swimming is permitted. The water is extremely cold. Most swimmers cannot stay in for more than a few minutes. Crater Lake's average water temperature is just 3 degrees Celsius. In summer, the lake's surface warms to about 10 degrees Celsius.
Visitors can also catch a boat from the end of Cleetwood Cove Trail. Park rangers lead visitors on boat rides around the lake. Visitors can also take boats to Wizard Island. The piece of land sits in the western part of the lake. Volcanic eruptions formed Wizard Island. It rises over 760 meters above the lake floor. However, most of the island, about 500 meters, is underwater. At Wizard Island, visitors can hike, swim, and fish. It is also a wonderful place to relax and enjoy nature. But such extraordinary places can be found all over the park. Discovering one's own is part of the magic to experience at Crater Lake National Park.
In 1830, only a few miles away from what is now the great city of Cincinnati, Ohio, lay a huge and almost endless forest. The area had a few settlements established by people of the frontier. Many of them had already left the area for settlements further to the west, but among those remaining was a man who had been one of the first people to arrive there. He lived alone, in a house of logs, surrounded on all sides by the great forest. He seemed a part of the darkness and silence of the forest, for no one had ever known him to smile or speak an unnecessary word. His simple needs were supplied by selling or trading the skins of wild animals in the town. His little log house had a single door. Directly opposite was a window. The window was boarded up. No one could remember a time when it was not. And no one knew why it had been closed. It surely was not because of the man's dislike of light and air. Sometimes he could be seen lying in the sun on his doorstep. I imagine there are few people living today who ever knew the secret of that window. But I am one, as you shall see. The man's name was said to be Murlock. He appeared to be 70 years old, but he was really 50. Something other than years had been the cause of his aging. His hair and long, full beard were white. His gray, lifeless eyes were sunken. His face was wrinkled. He was tall and thin, with drooping shoulders, like someone with many problems. I never saw him. These details I learned from my grandfather. He told me the man's story when I was a boy. He had known him when living nearby in that early day. One day, Murlock was found in his cabin, dead. It was not a time and place for medical examiners and newspapers. I suppose it was agreed that he had died from natural causes, or I should have been told and should remember. I know only that the body was buried near the cabin, next to the burial place of his wife. She had died so many years before him that local tradition noted very little of her existence. That closes the final part of this true story. Except for the incident that followed many years later. With a fearless spirit, I went to the place and got close enough to the ruined cabin to throw a stone against it. I ran away to avoid the ghost which every well-informed boy in the area knew haunted the spot. But there is an earlier part to this story, supplied by my grandfather. When Murlock built his cabin, he was young, strong, and full of hope. He began the hard work of creating a farm. He kept a gun, a rifle, for hunting to support himself. He had married a young woman in all ways worthy of his honest love and loyalty. She shared the dangers of life with a willing spirit and a light heart. There is no known record of her name or details about her. They loved each other and were happy. One day, Murlock returned from hunting in a deep part of the forest. He found his wife sick with fever and confusion. There was no doctor or neighbor within miles. She was in no condition to be left alone while he went to find help. So Murlock tried to take care of his wife and return her to good health. But at the end of the third day, she fell into unconsciousness and died. From what we know about a man like Murlock, we may try to imagine some of the details of the story told by my grandfather. When he was sure she was dead, Murlock had sense enough to remember that the dead must be prepared for burial. He made a mistake now and again while performing this special duty. He did certain things wrong, and others which he did correctly were done over and over again. He was surprised that he did not cry, surprised and a little ashamed. Surely it is unkind not to cry for the dead. "Tomorrow," he said out loud, "I shall have to make the coffin and dig the grave, and then I shall miss her when she is no longer in sight. But now, she is dead, of course. But it is all right. It must be all right somehow. Things cannot be as bad as they seem." He stood over the body of his wife in the disappearing light. He fixed the hair and made finishing touches to the rest. He did all of this without thinking, but with care. And still through his mind ran a feeling that all was right, that he should have her again as before, and everything would be explained. Murlock had no experience in deep sadness. His heart could not contain it all. His imagination could not understand it. He did not know he was so hard struck. That knowledge would come later and never leave. Deep sadness is an artist of powers that affects people in different ways. To one it comes like the stroke of an arrow, shocking all the emotions to a sharper life. To another it comes as the blow of a crushing strike. We may believe Murlock to have been affected that way. Soon after he had finished his work, he sank into a chair by the side of the table upon which the body lay. He noted how white his wife's face looked in the deepening darkness. He laid his arms upon the table's edge and dropped his face into them, tearless and very sleepy. At that moment, a long screaming sound came in through the open window. It was like the cry of a lost child in the far deep of the darkening forest, but the man did not move. He heard that unearthly cry upon his failing sense, again and nearer than before. Maybe it was a wild animal, or maybe it was a dream, for Murlock was asleep. Some hours later, he awoke, lifted his head from his arms, and listened closely. He knew not why. There, in the black darkness by the side of the body, he remembered everything without a shock. He strained his eyes to see he knew not what. His senses were all alert. His breath was suspended. His blood was still as if to assist the silence. Who, what had awakened him, and where was it? Suddenly the table shook under his arms. At the same time he heard, or imagined he heard, a light, soft step, and then another. The sounds were as bare feet walking upon the floor. He was afraid beyond the power to cry out or move. He waited, waited, there in the darkness, through what seemed like centuries of such fear. Fear as one may know, but yet live to tell. He tried, but failed to speak the dead woman's name. He tried, but failed to stretch his hand across the table to learn if she was there. His throat was powerless. His arms and hands were like lead. Then something most frightful happened. It seemed as if a heavy body was thrown against the table with a force that pushed against his chest. At the same time, he heard and felt the fall of something upon the floor. It was so violent a crash that the whole house shook. A fight followed, and a confusion of sounds impossible to describe. Murlock had risen to his feet. Extreme fear had caused him to lose control of his senses. He threw his hands upon the table. Nothing was there. There is a point at which fear may turn to insanity, and insanity incites to action. With no definite plan, and acting like a madman, Murlock ran quickly to the wall. He seized his loaded rifle and, without aim, fired it. The flash from the rifle hit the room with a clear brightness. He saw a huge, fierce panther dragging the dead woman toward the window. The wild animal's teeth were fixed on her throat. Then there was darkness, blacker than before, and silence. When he returned to consciousness, the sun was high, and the forest was filled with the sounds of singing birds. The body lay near the window, where the animal had left it when frightened away by the light and sound of the rifle. The clothing was ruined. The long hair was in disorder. The arms and legs lay in a careless way, and a pool of blood flowed from the horribly torn throat. The ribbon he had used to tie the wrists was broken. The hands were tightly closed, and between the teeth was a piece of the animal's ear.
Ah, I'm Katie Weaver with VOA Learning English. Thanks for listening.
It's music time.